the hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives that for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Elise Gling, sitting in for Steve Bertrand this week. Very nice to be here with you. You can find me online, LinkedIn, as I always tell Steve. You want people to be able to connect you every which way. BestMoneyMoves.com, my HR platform for companies to help them measure and then lower employee financial stress. And of course, ThinkLink.com, where we publish all sorts of information about money and real estate topics. Well, today is Wednesday, and that means that Terry Savage, money guru, Savage Truth Lady, is in the studio with me today. Delighted to have you with us, and we are taking your call, so get ready. Dial in now, 312-981-7200 with your questions. Terry, so nice to have you.
I love doing it together with you. It's just two chicks talking about money.
And, I know. What's better? What's sexier?
We've got some time, right? Exactly. Exactly.
Well, obviously, the big story today is what's going on with the Fed, and everybody is pins and needles, waiting, watching. We saw the market zoom yesterday in expectation that the Fed was actually going to lower interest rates, or at least give guidance that they are going to lower interest rates. What's your take on that?
Well, I think yesterday's was more a little bit of a relief that it looked like President Trump and Xi of China were going to meet, and that, you know, they might not be creating this global trade battle or extending it. And today it's quiet because nobody knows what's going to happen. The futures markets are telling you, have been saying, that it probably won't happen today. You know, less than an hour from now, we'll know. So we're just kind of whistling past the graveyard here.
Yeah, but we're not going to give it over to John when he comes in to do a show at 1 o'clock. We're just going to hang in.
Let's hang in here and discuss what's said.
Yeah.
So what's probably going to happen, 80% chance is that today the Fed will say something like, We're watching for signs of weakness in the economy. We're well aware that the tariffs are not only causing issues in our economy, but globally in terms of businesses planning and hiring and spending money to build new businesses. So we're very aware of that. That will probably satisfy the market and convince everyone that 99% chance of a rate cut when they meet again in July.
All right. So wait, but the question is, does that make people feel like the Fed is politicized and that, you know, they have to be concerned that Trump is actually the one calling the shots?
No, that's an unfortunate. Let me leave that aside for a second. There are some who say, well, as long as we all know that if the economy is slowing, they're going to probably do it in July, they ought to just do it today. But here's the Fed's big problem, aside from the political. Let's stick with the economic for a minute. Our rates aren't that high.
No.
And our economy isn't that slow. I mean, we're still at great employment numbers. We're still at pretty good GDP numbers and so forth. It's humming along. Yeah, it may be slowing. And by the way, well, we'll get to that. You could blame that on the president.
It's a 10-year expansion, so it would anyway.
And timing is right.
Yeah.
So, but if they start cutting now, what happens if there really is a financial crisis and they need to give the economy some boost? We're really at relatively low historical levels. So I think the Fed doesn't want to put itself in that spot, because if we had a crisis, I'm not saying we will, but like 2008, they wouldn't have much room to cut. I've mentioned this before. Back about 4 or 5 years ago, I was at something that Powell spoke at. He was a Fed governor, but not yet chairman. And I was being my perky self, and the headlines were that Europe had negative interest rates.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And Europe still is awash in negative interest rates,
right.
i.e., you pay the banks to hold your money because you're so worried about it.
Sure.
So I piped up and said, because our rates were very low at the time, and I think T-bill rates were at 0.08%, I said, sir, is there a chance that our short-term rates could go negative? And I swear if he had daggers in his eyes, he would have shot them at me. He said, the United States will not have negative interest rates.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I know where he stands on that. And I think that's a lot of pressure on the Fed not to cut too soon. So they have bullets left in case of a crisis.
Yeah,
politics is another story,
though. Yeah, well, the bullet thing is sort of interesting. But another bullet that's already been shot, I think, is being able to pull off some sort of a large, massive cash infusion which they did a very relatively small amount, but now you have so much more debt. The tax cuts have actually, guess what? They didn't pay for themselves. Huge surprise. So to nobody.
No.
And now
no,
what
no.
happens?
Wrong assumptions. You're going to get wrong conclusions.
I don't
for
know.
Starters, mm-hmm. For starters, let's talk about the injection of cash that the Fed put in 2008-2009 was monumental. The Fed's balance sheet, it just buys securities. It used to buy just treasury bills, notes, and bonds. It bought mortgage securities. It bought all kinds of stuff, loans and so forth, and dumped a ton of cash into the economy, which is still floating around. And part of the reason interest rates are so low around the world is there is just still so much cash. The Fed did not finish vacuuming up all the cash that it put in a decade ago, which is one reason why we're already at a low level of interest rates and why cutting rates or even pumping more cash in next time, if there's another crisis, won't be nearly as effective as it was 10 years ago.
That's my point, is that they don't have that arrow in their quiver anymore.
Exactly.
And so
arrows, whatever it is.
Exactly.
Ammunition.
And so what happens when, you know, we do face something, and we will face something, whether you're postponing it until, and I hate to get political again, after the election, as opposed to before the election, is a matter of question. But there will be another downturn because there's always been another downturn.
Exactly. Now, what does that mean for everyone out there? Well, let's just think about a couple of things. I just looked. The Standard & Poor 500 stock index is like within a hair of its all-time highs, made in April. We never quote the S&P 500, but it is a broader index. It's at, the highs were 29.33. Today, we're 29.16.
Wow.
So we are right up, bumping up against the highs. The Dow Jones is a little bit further off its highs, but very close, relatively speaking. So the question for people out there who don't want to, you know, split hairs about what the Fed's, you know, balance sheet looks like is, so what does this mean for my stock market investments? You are the one that just mentioned so correctly that we're in the longest economic recovery. We are also now in the longest bull market.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, it's like Clint Eastwood, do you feel lucky? If you're in your 20s or 30s, I mean, you know, I believe in the future of America. We'll get through all this stuff. But what about if you're retiring next year or you're already retired and not contributing anymore? Do you want to ride out the stock market and make a bet that it's going to blow through this and make new highs? I think it's 50-50, but do you want to bet your retirement on that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I definitely want to get to everybody else's questions. So 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can call in. And after the traffic break, we're going to get to some of these calls. I think the quick answer to your question is, what is and there is no quick answer, right? What does retirement look like in terms of years or decades now for people? And the idea when Social Security started that you were going to take it at 65 and be dead by 66 or 67 no longer is appropriate, because now everybody's living until their mid-80s and even sometimes into, you know, mid-90s or mid-100s, not 150, but 101, 102, 103. And you know, if you've got that 20 or 30 years still ahead of you, I think you'd be foolish not to keep a large chunk of your portfolio in a broadly diversified, cheap index fund. I think it would be silly to just go all to bonds or all to cash.
Well, first of all, bonds, you can lose as much money in bonds when rates go up. So that's not the alternative. The question is, where does your mind work? So if you have 20 or 25 or 30% in cash, and it's enough to cover your required withdrawals for the next 4 or 5 years, obviously, there's never been a 20-year period where you lost money in a diversified American stock portfolio, but you don't want to be the one that panics and sell when the market's down 24%, going down 30 or 40, you know, average bear market, 37%, many 45% or more losses. So I'm talking about your heart attack. You know, you could shorten your retirement quickly if you're 100% invested in stocks and the market's down a lot. And that's the kind of thinking it's wise to do at any point, but particularly now.
So we were just talking about retirement, and in the break I said to Terry, you know, we really should, and we're happy to take your calls, 312-981-7200, but I think we should talk a little bit about the mistakes that people do make. Well, this is what we were doing as we were going into the break, starting to talk about at what age you should just liquidate everything, or do you want to liquidate at the bottom of the market or at the top? Clearly not the bottom. Maybe at the top. How do you know it's the top? I mean, When you think and counsel people, when you think about this topic of how do I make mistakes or how do I avoid making mistakes, what are the top couple of mistakes that people who are nearing retirement typically make?
I can come up with about three real quickly. The first mistake is taking retirement as an absolute cutoff of income. If you can avoid just dropping off the income strata right there and figure out a way to work, continue to work part-time or consult for your company, because then they won't have to pay benefits, but you're going to get Medicare, for example, and that's okay. You just need some cash coming in. I don't think retirement should be a cliff. The second biggest mistake people make is taking Social Security before full retirement age. That is like costing yourself not only 8% a year in benefits, and I don't know any investment right now, even the stock market at this stage of the game, that's going to guarantee you 8% a year over the next coming years. So you need to work to your full retirement age. Yeah, they'll print the money. It'll be there for you. And on top of which, if inflation comes back, then you've got a higher base on which they'll make those inflation adjustments. So just jumping off like it's a cliff is a bad mistake if you can avoid it, if you can take on some other part-time work or do some consulting, and taking Social Security early, and then not planning carefully about how you're going to do your withdrawals. I mean, your required minimum withdrawals are set up by the government, but they're set up to end your pot of gold there by the time you're in your mid-80s. And as you pointed out, go to livingto100.com and take the quiz. Your odds of living to the late 80s or mid-90s are getting better and better. And you got to think about, what about the money later on? And I will give you the fourth one right now. You didn't know I was going to go on a whole catalog.
I didn't. There's actually a question about this, but carry on.
The fourth one is not doing something about long-term care insurance, which is a whole other topic, next week's column. But I know rates went up on premiums went up on those policies. There's new policies out, combination life long-term care, where if you don't use the benefits for long-term care, your heirs get a life insurance benefit. But not thinking about the cost of long-term care is another big retirement mistake.
No, I think it really is. Let's go to the phones. Marie has a question. Hey, Marie, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Terry, thank you for all of these conversations you have every week. I listen to them diligently, and nice. I worry. My husband and I are retired. My husband is working. He has a part-time job, just like you talked about. We have a long-term care, both policies for both of us. We've been diligent in doing what
good.
We need to do. We look at our investments. They're with a good firm. And when we look at them, they're going down. They've been going down. And it's so nervous when we get that monthly report and look at it and say, oh my gosh, are we going to be able to make it? Are we going to be able to make it? Because we're taking some of that money, like maybe 5% of it out or 6% of it out to live on, because I'm taking Social Security. I took it at 66. I waited. My husband hasn't taken his yet. He's going to wait till 70.
Good.
But the concern is,
you're worried with a good reason.
Oh,
because
yes.
Taking 6% out absolutely ensures that you're going to run out of money before you run out of time. Even all other things being equal, it's a bad ratio. It used to be that they said you could take 4% out and then maybe adjust for inflation. We haven't had inflation. You may be with a very good investment firm, but have you gone to a financial planner, a fiduciary, one puts your interests first, fee-only financial planner, to get some advice on your withdrawal rate? Have you done that?
He's talked to us about the withdrawal rate, and we're trying to get it down. And when Jim gets to that 70 point, it's going to help to take it down, because that money that we'll be getting from Social Security will bring it down. But even so, what is the golden number? Because
there is no magic number. There's a lot of great software called Monte Carlo modeling. And if your financial advisor has been trying to talk to you about this, ask him or her to put this on a chart and show you at the average rates of return and dividends reinvested, the way you're invested, how quickly you'll run out of money. You can't guess at this, but it's best to be conservative. And I will tell you the other thing that'll make a difference right now. He's working. How about you? This is your good time for the next 5 years. If you could bring in an extra $1,000 a month after taxes, that would make a huge difference. And if you the longer you postpone withdrawals, you're not required to take yours yet, and till 70 and a half. If you could go the next 5 years, You said you're 66 or 67?
Yeah, they're both in their late 60s.
So if you could go the next 4 or 5 years without taking one penny out, it would do more to secure your retirement. And the way you do that is figure out what you can do to earn some money.
But I have to say, Marie,
no magic wand.
No, there isn't. But, you know, if you just have a couple of years until your husband starts taking his Social Security at age 70 and you've built up all that extra income is going to come back to you. And so I think that Terry's exactly right. What you want to do is to bring in a little bit of extra income and put off taking any more withdrawals while you can. And we hope that goes well for you. And you can find out more great advice from Terry Savage at terrysavage.com. And thank you for being with us, Terry.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Steve Bertrand this week. You can find me online, bestmoneymoves.com, thinklink.com. And if we didn't get to your question last segment with Terry Savage, you can go to terrysavage.com, or you can just send it to me at ThinkLink, and I'll send you an answer later on this afternoon, or maybe tomorrow morning. All right, we have a longtime friend of mine on the phone with us right now. Steve Ely is a former president of the Personal Solutions Division of Equifax, a longtime credit geek, and he is now the CEO of a company called eCredible. And what eCredible does is it helps people establish business credit. In addition to people who don't have any credit, it'll help you as well on a personal level. But I wanted to talk to you today, Steve, on a business level about credit and the mistakes that people sometimes make when they're starting a company and they need some credit and they don't know where to turn. So first, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thanks, Elise. It's great to talk with you again.
Well, it's very nice to have you here as well. So, Steve, when people are, you know, starting up businesses, oftentimes they need money and they don't know where to turn, so they end up in trouble and they're, you know, end up renting, trying to get money from places, and because they don't have credit, they end up paying, you know, really through the nose. So maybe start by talking about how business credit is very different from the personal credit you've established over the years.
Yeah, so, you know, anybody that's going to start a business is obviously a consumer first and a business person second. And so when we get started out just starting businesses and you go to a banker or a lender or whatever and you want to get a line of credit or a business loan or maybe you want to apply for a business credit card, they're going to always look at your personal credit first because you don't have any business credit history yet. If you have a track record of building a business and you have some evidence that you did that successfully and you were, you know how to manage your money financially, you might be able to go to a banker that knows you, and they won't use your personal credit necessarily to extend a line of a business credit to you. But most people, that won't be the case. So when you're starting out, the most important thing you can do is to make sure that your personal credit is in the best shape it can possibly be. Because when you go and apply for that business credit card, even if you have a business credit score, they're probably not even going to look at it at that point. And so just make sure that your personal credit is pristine, in good shape. If you need to get a hold of a credit report and check it out and make sure there's no errors in there and it's cleaned up and that sort of thing, do that ahead of time. But it's just so important for people to understand that when you're first starting out, unfortunately, you cannot separate your personal credit from your business credit. Don't even try to, because the lenders are definitely going to want to look at your personal credit first.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. And when you start, you know, but commingling that can cause some problems on the business front, right? Because if your business then goes down, your personal credit is going to tank as well, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that affects a lot of small businesses. I think, you know, the statistics are not encouraging to start a small business. You know, a lot of them go out of business pretty quickly. But assuming you're going to start a business because you want to be successful, otherwise, why would you be doing this?
That's right. You're going to make $100 million like everybody else starting a small business.
You're going to go into eyes wide open and become rich overnight.
Right.
It doesn't normally work that way. But what you want to think about is how can you separate the two as quickly as possible? So if we think about when you first get started, you're going to have to use your personal credit. You just can't get around that. But let's say in year two or year three, as you're starting to grow your business, you're making more money, you probably need more money to grow your business. Maybe you're hiring more employees, you need more payroll. Maybe you're building more product, you need to buy more inventory. You're going to need access to capital. You need access to more credit lines and maybe more trade credit with your suppliers. So in that case, what you want to try to do as quickly as you possibly can is start to establish a business credit profile, so when you apply for those kinds of trade lines and lines of credit and business credit cards, you no longer have to use your personal information when you apply. Why that is so important is because when you commingle your personal credit and your business credit, if something goes wrong with your business, the creditors are going to come after your personal assets. If you personally guarantee that line of credit or that credit card or that trade reference or whatever it might be. So just as soon as you possibly can, you want to make sure that you separate the two, that you never use your personal information to guarantee anything in the name of the business. That way, if anything goes wrong with the business at some point in the future, then it's a business failure, not a personal failure, and they can't come after your personal assets.
All right, so we know that Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion manage sort of the world of personal credit. They're the three major credit reporting bureaus, and they are responsible for working with all of the lenders and the creditors, and they get your information, they update it. Who does business credit? Is it the same three?
Well, the exception is TransUnion and Dun & Bradstreet. So, for example, as you stated, in the consumer world, it's Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. In the business world, it's Equifax, Experian, and Dun & Bradstreet. Those are the big three. TransUnion doesn't do business and commercial credit. And so the other challenge in the business world is, even though there's the big three, there are dozens of other smaller ones that you've probably never heard of. And the challenge in the business world is that when you try to do business with somebody else, you set up a line of credit, you apply for credit, you're talking to investors, maybe potential partners, potential customers, potential suppliers, you really never know which business credit report they're going to pull when they look at your business. And so, unfortunately, it's the responsibility of the business owner to make sure that all that information is accurate and thorough and clean, because the business credit reporting world doesn't have the same regulatory environment, the same controls in place that we have as consumers. As a consumer, there is only three, and we all know that no one can look at your personal credit report without your permission. That's against the law. And the business credit world, there are no laws. It's the Wild Wild West.
Ooh.
And so anybody that knows the name of your business, I happen to know the name of your business, I could go right now to Dun & Bradstreet and buy your business credit report without your knowledge and without your permission. And if I saw something in that report that didn't seem right or made you look bad or didn't present your business in the best light, I might make a negative decision about doing business with you, and you may not never know that. And so, unfortunately, for the small business owner, most of them don't really understand this, and I think it's important for the small business owner, either for the startup or for the young company, to realize that you just have to pay attention to that information being stored in your business credit reports, because you just never know who's going to look at it and when they're going to look at it.
All right, so if it's important to know what's going on in your business credit report, how exactly do we do that? Like, do you go to Dun & Bradstreet? Do you make sure you have a DUNS number or whatever it is they call it over there?
Yep.
Do you have to regularly check in with them? How does that work?
Yeah, so when you first get started, it's the responsibility of the small business owner to make sure you actually have business credit files already set up. So Dun & Bradstreet's a bit unique. They're the only one that you actually can go to their website and say, hey, I need a DUNS number. I want to apply for a DUNS number. A DUNS is there. It's the equivalent of a Social Security number for a business, just to kind of think of it that way. And so you set up your DUNS number, and now anybody that wants to report information to Dun & Bradstreet, that's the identifier for your company, so that they can uniquely find your company and make sure that any information gets reported about your company gets associated with that DUNS number. So Dun & Bradstreet's a little bit unique. So now let's pick on Equifax and Experian as an example, their business credit files. The way that they generate a business credit file is after you've set up a line of credit or a business credit card or a supplier party. When those guys set that account up for you, they're going to report that information, your payment to those companies, to Experian and Equifax. The problem you write, so that'll generate a file for you. Now you've got a business credit file at those two bureaus. The problem that you have that it's just almost impossible to stay on top of is you don't know who these companies report to, and they're not always really clear about who they report to. And so you might go get a business credit card with, I'll just pick, Capital One. Bitcoin as an example. And you may not know who they're reporting your monthly payments to. And so it's incumbent upon you to make sure that you monitor the information at the major bureaus to make sure that it is being reported, that it is accurate, and it's helping you build a business credit score.
Which is, you know, at the end of the day, incredibly important, as you pointed out. Steve Ely, thank you so much for being with us. It's amazingly helpful information. eCredible is a company that helps businesses build credit. And where can we find out more?
Just go to www.business.ecredible.com. That's spelled ECREDABLE.com.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you, Elise.
Okay. It is 12:46. Stand by. We'll be back with more of the Wintrust Business Lunch, but first, the Wintrust Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. You ever find yourself wanting to time travel back before posting something on social media? But as soon as those things get out online, they might as well be up there forever. Forever. Thankfully, there are crisis communication firms that are more relevant than ever these days. Crisp is a UK-based firm that's hopping across the pond to plant its roots here in Chicago. They provide services to a number of Fortune 500 companies, but now they'll also have the opportunity to hire at least 25 Chicago employees. So I may have posted a picture of my foot on my company's Twitter page. Is that bad? Yeah, man, that's bad. But what's not bad is two Chicago hospitals making the list of best children's hospitals for 2019 and 2020. Lori Children's and Advocate cracked the list, but at the end of the day, these pieces are a little bit of fluff and mostly reference for patients, because it's good to know what kind of hospitals are around you. Hey, man, I got my phone stuck in my foot. Is that bad? Ugh, this guy. I'm Bennett Wake Knight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm here all week, and you can find me online at LinkedIn, bestmoneymoves.com if you're interested in reducing employee financial stress, or thinklink.com if you're interested in all things personal finance. Frank Sennett, Director of Digital Strategy at Crane Chicago Business, joins me on the line now for our weekly check-in. I think it's weekly, isn't it, Frank? Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Good to be here.
It's nice to have you. So lots going on in the city today besides this crash up in at 94 and the fact that I feel like I live in San Francisco with the weather, right? Tell us what you're watching today.
Well, I, you know, am really interested in this swing that Lori Lightfoot took to New York. She, you know, is really trying to set the table for good relationships with the folks that are going to make a lot of decisions that affect our ability as a city to get bonds issued and the rates that we'll pay. So she met yesterday with Fitch Ratings, and then she sat down with Jamie Dimon, Chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, which is the city's largest lender. So she seems to be really making the rounds to try to get us on a good footing.
You know, it's interesting. We were just talking on the show with Steve Ely of eCredible about how important it is to establish business credit, especially when you're just starting out. And here in the city, you know, we are in a challenging credit environment for us. You know, our ratings are not great. We have a lot of debt in the state, as everybody knows.
That's right.
And she's kind of stepped in and stepped forward. And I think it's hopefully going to face this. It sounds like she's starting to face it head on very early in her administration. Is that your the Crane's take on it as well?
I think so. I mean, we have a big ChicagoBusiness.com hashtag Lightfoot 100 looking at her first 100 days in office. And certainly it does seem like she's focused on pulling as many levers as possible to get our financial house in order. But, I mean, there's, you know, seemingly intractable problems that we still face with pensions and as you say, the interest rates we're paying on some of these bonds, our credit rating is not good. There's a lot of digging out of the hole to do.
Now, some people are saying that she's taking, you know, it a little too far. Is she actually going to be on Stephen Colbert tonight? Is that what I read?
Yeah. So as part of this trip to New York, she did tape a performance or an appearance, rather, on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And her, you know, spokesperson pushed back against the idea that it was a frivolous trip by citing these two meetings with the bond agency. And but, you know, Stephen Colbert who could pass that up?
Listen, I wouldn't pass it up, but I actually think it's a really it's a smart move, right? She's got to raise the awareness that Chicago is a thriving, growing community, that we offer so much for digital businesses, for, you know, manufacturing, for all things, and that we're here in the middle of the country. Hello, notice us. We're worthy too. And I think Stephen Colbert commands a lot of eyeballs. I think it's a smart move.
Yeah, I agree. And speaking of, you know, the path you just walked down, the other story I was looking at was WeWork, the co-working space, has now hit 1 million square feet in Chicago as more and more companies look to this flexible office rental model. WeWork has really outstripped almost every employer in downtown Chicago in terms of the amount of square footage.
And I think that that's kind of an incredible thing as well. It's sort of come out of nowhere over the last 15 years. I'm not even sure they're 15 years old, to remake how we think about working space, right? It went from even beyond the idea that you're going to just take offices and make them over as cubes. They took cubes out of the mix and made it into this kind of flexible environment, which makes it very affordable for people to be able to say, I have a downtown Chicago office, you know, in a way that I think some of the other companies just never kind of caught the imagination of the new generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is taking off in an amazing way. Downtown Chicago will have 3.2 million square feet total of co-working space by the end of this year, and 4.2 million by the end of 2020, according to data from the brokerage Newmark Knight Frank. So it is, you know, the million from WeWork is supplanted by there's other competitive companies that are coming in, and they really are seeing a lot of demand. These offices are not empty.
That's amazing. Well, Frank, thank you so much for dropping by today. You want to be sure to tune in to the Crane Daily Gist, which you can find the link online, right, at cranechicagobusiness.com.
At chicagobusiness.com and on iTunes. And, yeah, our you know, wonderful host, Amy Guth, who's also one of the WGN's shining stars. So, we commend that to you every afternoon, Monday through Thursday.
Wonderful. Frank, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.